sex addiction? Is that what Dr. Bev is going to talk about today? Yes, she certainly is. Yes, I certainly am. We're going to talk about sexual addiction. How is it diagnosed? Is a sex addict a pedophile? All the questions you wanted to know, including one that a friend of mine asks, which is, what is a nymphomaniac?
Finally, a psychotherapist that focuses on helping people strive for self-awareness and thrive for self-satisfaction with their place in the world. It's a show for real people with real lives, with all the drama, trauma, and chaos that life can throw at you. Here she is, Dr. Bev.
Yes, here today with me is Ava. And Ava, pronounce your last name so I don't mess it up.
Profada, Ava Profada.
There you go. May I call you just Ava today?
Absolutely. That works just fine.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being on the show today. Ava is the founder of Inner Loop Counseling, an outpatient treatment center with multi-levels of care for sex and love addictions. She is also voted Addictions Counselor of the Year by the Houston Regional Texas Association. Again, welcome to Emotions Are Us, Ava.
Thank you.
Well, let's get this party started. If we could, let's start off with my friend's question. Okay. Tell us, what is a nymphomaniac? And if your partner is one, how would you know that?
The word nymphomaniac is a non-clinical term, and the new terminology for that is actually sex addiction. So they are actually one and the same. It's someone with a hypersexual drive.
And so would that mean that if that person wasn't able to have sex, would they get, what would their emotions be? Would they be angry? Would they get upset? How would you know when they've crossed the line with their hypersexuality?
So the experience for them is that they would feel angry, restless, irritable, discontent. Unless they had just recently had a sexual encounter. But when they are busy with other things, early on when the addiction first starts, they're not as apt to engage in a lot more sex than usual. It starts really small and it works up until it's very unmanageable. And so just like we would diagnose somebody with chemical dependence or what we now call substance use disorder, we look at the same criteria. And so some of the things we look at are not how much or how often or how long are you doing it, but what are they not doing? Are they missing work? Are they missing other social areas of their lives? Are they not doing any hobbies? And when they're supposed to be somewhere, are they, you know, acting out with their sexual addiction instead of fulfilling those obligations? And so once they have gone on a binge, a lot of them may not be sexual for a day or two. So it really depends on how dysfunctional the rest of their life is. For people who have a hyper sex drive, they may never cross the line into actual sex addiction until, you know, maybe something happens at work, or maybe their spouse catches them doing something that is against their own values and against the spouse's values, in particular, outside sexual contact with a different partner other than a spouse or the primary partner.
So it sounds like stress has something to do with that as well.
Yes, absolutely. The things that we would normally feel stressed over will be a trigger for them to want to go and act out sexually, because they actually use sex the same way an alcoholic uses alcohol. So they use it to reduce their uncomfortable feelings.
That is really profound. having worked in substance abuse for a long time, I would imagine, as you said, it's a crossover, it's a carryover. It's still an addiction. And
yes,
when it
is.
Begins to affect your life and those of your loved ones, when you cross your own boundaries, that's
right.
when you know you're in trouble. Now, you're the owner of the treatment center. Tell me, what does the person walking in with sexual addictions, can you give me sort of like their biopsychosocial, if you would, of what it would look like?
Yes. So we have, I would say, half and half single women or men, and then married women or men that come in. We get a lot more male sex addicts here than we do female sex addicts, but usually they'll either come in having had a relationship ruined, or their current spouse just found out, or the current partner just found out that they've been acting out in a sexual way that is against their own values for both of them. And so they'll come in and they'll start doing some work. Maybe we'll do an assessment, and then we do individual, and generally then we'll put them into a group. But then we ask the spouse, the partner or the spouse, to come in, because we want to make sure that the spouse gets treatment as well. Because just like with chemical dependence, if you only treat the person who has a chemical dependence, they're much more likely to relapse if you're not treating the whole family, and especially in this case, the partner. Now, the partner comes in with PTSD. A lot of psychologists have kind of said, what are you talking about? They can't possibly have PTSD. Well, they do, because their world got turned upside down, whether it's a life partner or a marital partner. The spouse comes in with pretty severe PTSD symptoms, and they're really angry. They have a high startle response. They're having nightmares. They're angry, and they're wanting to lash out at their partner. They can't sleep. You know, all the typical symptoms of PTSD. And so we have to do a lot of trauma work, for example, EMDR or somatic experiencing or tapping. We do a lot of trauma arousal work to get their trauma down to a place where they can actually think. They kind of have a fuzzy brain. They can't remember anything. And so when the sex addict comes in and starts to get sober, they're feeling a whole lot better, and they can't understand why their partner is in so much distress. So oftentimes there is a partner associated with the sex addict that also needs treatment, but it's not always true. We have people from, you know, every walk of life in our practice, because we're an all cash practice. Our clientele are upper echelon type people. And so, you know, it's a different kind of clientele, and we have to treat them a little bit differently. But you can't use the common form of working with the partner in this addiction like you would with chemical dependence, because they have severe trauma. And it's a very different treatment for partners of sex addicts.
I imagine that it would. And it makes sense to me that they would have PTSD, that's post-traumatic stress disorder, that they would encounter
yes.
that, because if they were left in the dark and didn't know about their partners or their husbands or wives proclivity, then they build up a life, and all of a sudden, all of that comes crashing down. And perhaps it's not all
yes.
of a sudden, because in reference to their sexual addiction, I imagine that it is a process, as you mentioned earlier, in that as they come into their own about what their sexual habits are and going outside of the home, say they're married or they have a partner, their partner doesn't know anything about it. They may have some clues, maybe, that behaviors are different.
Right.
You know, but they're just not sure. The partner may be acting out with them in sexual ways that isn't their norm, or
right.
or the want to do certain things with them that they haven't been doing in their relationship. And it's all of a sudden, and that's kind of like, okay, well, that's a little note there, but still they don't really know. So it's understandable for me in terms of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, that the partner would have, because when the addiction goes off the rails and they end up at your clinic, that's a high sign that a lot has gone on, a lot of experiences, a lot of negativity, could even be volatile or whatever. And most sexual addictions, correct me if I'm wrong, are usually clued in with some sort of substance abuse.
Oftentimes they'll either have a substance use disorder, they may have an eating disorder, they could have a financial disorder. So many different things.
It's all over it's all over the board there.
Most of them come in with most of them come in with at least one other addiction.
That I can understand that. Yeah, that
and
they
I wanted
would.
To address something you said earlier, because that was very important. Sometimes they may be asking their partners to do something different sexually in the relationship, and sometimes the partner has a little clue, sometimes the partner knows a lot more, and sometimes they don't know anything that's going on with their partner, and they're so shocked. And those generally have a little bit more PTSD. But another thing that happens with sex addicts and their partners is that the sex addict can be extremely compulsive outside of the relationship and completely anorexic sexually inside the relationship.
Wow, that's a slap in the face.
Yes, it is. And partners are very upset about that.
I would imagine so, especially if you think that you have gotten into a loving relationship and you find out that, wow, this is just not so.
Right. And so the partner feels like, what's wrong with me? Am I not lovable? Am I not sexy enough? They have all sorts of issues around their body image.
We're gonna get back to that. I wanted to go back for a moment, and because you mentioned something about treatment modalities, you mentioned tapping, which I do in my practice. You also mentioned EMDR. Can we explain to our audience so they'll know if they might need these particular forms of treatment or therapy, and what would be the conditions in which they would come in with, like you said, post-traumatic stress disorder. So could you explain to me how the EMDR tapping, what exactly is that for our audience?
So, excuse me, EMDR is eye movement desensitization reprocessing. It's kind of hard to say. And it's a form of therapy that is extremely well researched. And so there are protocols, I'm personally not EMDR trained, but we have several client therapists here that are EMDR trained. And so I may do some of the therapy, and then some of the folks who are EMDR trained may do some of the therapy. We also have groups and then individual. So when the client comes in, they need a whole lot more than just individual therapy. But EMDR is really important for all of our clients, not just the partners who have severe PTSD when they come in, but also for the addict, because they have traumatized themselves a lot of times. And there's rarely a sex addict that walks in our door that doesn't have some childhood relational trauma, or, you know, maybe even physical trauma from their childhood. So the addicts need it as well. And it helps to decrease the symptoms of the PTSD. Their trauma arousal is really high for the partners. And for the addicts, they're in a lot of distress and anxiety, because they don't know if the partner is going to stay with them, if they want to stay in their relationship, or if there's going to be a divorce that happens. And they're not sure if their partner can continue to be in the marriage after having been sexually betrayed in the marriage.
Exactly. And tapping, how does that help and the partners, the wives, the husbands of the sexual addict?
So when we are in session, either an individual or in group, and either the partner or the addict starts to have a lot of trauma arousal. They're feeling high anxiety. Maybe they're even at the point of having a panic attack, especially, for example, when the sex addict is preparing for what we call a formal disclosure, where they're going to disclose to their spouse or their partner everything that they've done. The terror of doing that is huge. So maybe the partner is in high trauma arousal because they're so in so much pain and their world has been turned upside down. Or if the addict is working on his disclosure paperwork, every time he thinks of something else, it may just send him through the roof with anxiety because he's so afraid of how his wife or husband or partner is going to take that. And many addicts are so secretive and they have this dual life. So what happens for them is for the first time, people are starting to know every part of their life. And that's frightening for them.
And so the tapping is a form of the process or a tool that they can use to bring down some of their hypersensitivity in those moments. Like you said, as an example, when they're doing that part of the process where they are revealing their secrets, and with that comes a lot of shame. And so in that moment,
yes,
you can have someone, you know, as I said, just become so anxiety ridden that tapping is a form of taking your hand and your fingers and putting it on the clavicle, and and doing a slight tapping. And audience, you can try this just as a form of bringing yourself, as I call it, back into your body. And take it and just right around your neck, shoulder areas there, and just take your fingers and just tap gently there. And there's a process with that where you can just bring yourself down and bring yourself back into your body. Just wanted to put that piece of information out there. Is there something you wanted to add to that in terms of tapping?
That is really important because exactly what you said, anybody can use it, and you can look it up on the internet, and there's very little risk of doing harm to yourself. And so we ask our partners and our addicts, when they start to feel high anxiety, to start tapping. Even if they're feeling really angry and they want to lash out at their partner, they can tap, maybe call somebody and do some tapping. There's so many different ways to decrease the intensity of the feeling. For example, anxiety or fear, panic, anger, irritability, and even with guilt and shame, because the addicts experience so much guilt and shame.
Wow, let's talk about that when we come back from our break, and that is guilt and shame, and also childhood trauma. We'll be right back with you. This is Emotions R Us.
The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. It's AmericaOutloud.com, where the conversation never ends. With 24/7 streaming on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Welcome back. We were talking about sexual addiction and childhood traumas and the anxiety and anger and irritability that goes with that in terms of a relationship. Now, Ava, you said that most of your clients come in and most of them have some childhood traumas. Are we talking childhood sexual traumas, emotional or physical?
Most of them have, if not what we call overt sexual trauma, they may also have what we call covert sexual trauma. And I'll talk about overt because that's the one we mostly know about. Someone touched them or actually tried to have sex with them, or insinuated that they wanted to have sex with them. Now, there's another type of sexual trauma that we call covert sexual trauma. And that occurs when a child has been asked to be more emotionally intelligent than they are at their age. So, for example, mom or dad is talking to one child about the other parent. And so they're basically confiding in them as though they were either a friend or a surrogate parent or surrogate spouse. And when parents have that type of relationship with their child, they often don't realize that it's causing some emotional sexual harm because the child gets confused. For example, I have many men who, when they were growing up, they lived with a single mom and maybe had very little or no contact with their father. So they never got the mentoring from their father that they needed. And mom just has this child, this male child. And so she begins to treat that child as though they're older and more emotionally mature than what they are. And that creates a lot of confusion and sometimes hidden anger, or what we call repressed anger, on the part of the male adult once they're grown up. And so both of those happen a lot in our population. I hope that helps to explain that.
It does. And it also says to me, especially in that kind of trauma where the child is asked to be an adult, asked to be perfect. I see a lot of that with eating disorders, that they've had that kind of trauma, childhood trauma in their life, always trying to meet expectations of being the best friend, or as one of my clients put it years ago, you know, at age 10, 8 or 10, he was expected to be the man of the house because the father had died. There is no way that the only boy child could be the man of the house. In that same token, I get females with eating disorders or cutting and that kind of thing, where the parent has asked them to be an overachiever, such the overachiever, right, to meet their expectations. In a sense, they're living out the parent's life or what the parent wanted to do, maybe be a ballerina or whatever, a doctor, a lawyer. It doesn't matter. It's just that pressure that's put on the child. And so they come out of
exactly
that, they come out of that with this need to overextend themselves in another area, and I can see where that could lead to sexual addictions.
And entitlement goes with what you just said. A lot of our addicts feel entitled to go act out sexually because many of them are workaholics. That was one of the addictions I forgot to name earlier. Then they work so hard, work all the time, and then they feel entitled to go do whatever they want to sexually to try to relieve the stress and the pressure.
We definitely see that a lot on it. Emotions Are Us. We definitely see that, where that sense of entitlement, and it appears to me that more and more of our population has that sense in 2018, that they're entitled to do whatever they like because they've already met a certain monetary lifestyle. Like you said, they're workaholics. They have everything. What do you get the person who has everything? Oh, right. You get them a threesome.
You know, right.
That seems to be the thing these days. You get a threesome. And it's a sense of entitlement that draws others into their own web of anxiety and entitlement. They feel as one said to me as I was working on this show, well, you know, I work hard, I play hard, and You know, I paid for this. You know, I paid right. for this person to have sex with me. I paid for them to do certain things that my wife or partner, I pay for them to do certain things that my wife or partner will not do with me, or I don't think that they'll be comfortable with.
And that is one of the misbeliefs that they have, that in this world I have to take care of myself. If you think about the workaholic, this is generally your hero child. And with the hero child, what they've learned is to not allow anybody else to help them. And so they deprive themselves in some of the most crucial areas of good self-care, and then they will indulge in other areas that are not truly good self-care. They may think that they are taking care of themselves, but it's not something that's truly going to bring them a sense of warmth and self-love. And also, another piece around sex addiction that I get asked a lot, that I wanted to certainly address this, is, do we see sex as a bad thing? We don't. We see sex as something very positive, and we don't discourage them from having a good sexual relationship with their partner. They do need a period of abstinence, but as soon as that period of abstinence is over and there's a new neural pathway in the brain, we want them to start being emotionally connected to their partner and gradually move back into a sexual experience. And as long as, for example, if they wanted to have a threesome, if that was a part of their values and both people were agreeable, that's not something that we would discourage, but we would check to see, is this going to trigger that old neural pathway that is too much excitement? Because the thing that happens in the brain is that they load a boatload of dopamine from the ventral tegmental area into the nucleus accumbens and then to the prefrontal cortex. So when our addicts come in, their prefrontal cortex is offline, and we're trying to reestablish good executive functioning, making good decisions, because they will throw caution to the wind. Just like with chemical dependence, this is a progressive disease. And so their thinking, our thinking goes along about what I call the plus or minus two standard deviations of our culture's thinking, but theirs starts to go off on a tangent. And by the time they get here, their thinking and the normal public thinking is very different. But after they've had a period of abstinence and treatment, they will look back at the behavior they did and with shock and horror. They can't believe that they thought that way or did those things. It really affects the brain, and especially the prefrontal cortex.
And as you were saying, with all those big words for my listening audience, basically what you're saying is their thinking is just not right.
It's not right. That's correct.
It is off kilter. And they don't know it's off kilter because, as you said, they're going for that overexcitement. And that overexcitement lends them into some seedy areas of life, going to maybe parts of the town that they live in that they may not ordinarily go to, or
high risk behavior.
The person is going for that high excitement, and it's going to lead them into some risky behaviors, maybe going to parts of their town or their city where they may not normally go to, but they know they can buy the type of sex that they want to have, or putting themselves in a position where they're not going to work and following up on their regular workaholic activities because they feel like, okay, that sense of entitlement. I feel like I'm owed this. So I'm a telephone addict. And so what I'm doing, and again, that the brain is not thinking. They'll say to themselves, well, I'm going to take the day off because I deserve it, and I'm going to stay home, and I'm going to indulge myself for all the hours that no one else is at home. So that's like 8 to 10 hours there. And so they have all of this time, and they may not have to go out. They may be a telephone addict where they don't want to see that partner, but they still want that sense of adrenaline rush, that drive. And they'll tell themselves, as you probably have encountered, like you said, their brain, their thinking process is way off. The telephone addict will think that he or she is better than that person who is out on the avenue picking up a prostitute.
Right.
Or a sex worker. And they'll think they're better because they're in the privacy of their home. And again, that secrecy comes out. Nobody knows. And but then it gets wound up again.
Exactly. And I want to address the adrenaline piece. That is a key part of this addiction. So when you think about how alcoholism, for example, escalates, you drink more and you drink more and you drink more because the brain just sort of numbs out to the original amount of alcohol that it took for you to feel intoxicated. Well, with sex, there's only so many things that you can do to try to make it bigger, better, more exciting. And so what a lot of them do will start to do the high-risk behavior, and it really causes the adrenaline to flow. And so if you put together dopamine, which is the chemical in our brain that causes this excitement, and then you add a little adrenaline to that, it magnifies the feeling or the intensity of that dopamine rush. And so that's another way for them to increase the intensity or the high that they get with the sex addiction. So you'll see many of them doing very high risk behaviors. There's so many different kinds of sex addicts. There's the porn addict. There's the telephone chat line addict. There's the voyeur online. And then there's the voyeur who wants to go out into the public. And voyeurism means I want to see someone in a sexual way or doing something sexual. Or they may do what we call exhibitionism. And so that's a really big rush for those people who have that, what we call sexual arousal template, that want to other people to see them in a sexual way and may expose themselves. And then there's the addict that just wants to use sex workers. So there's so many different ways that that addicts show up, and some of them overlap, but you may see somebody who's never done anything except porn. Online porn in the privacy of their bedroom. But what happens is that starts to leak over into work. I've had so many of them get fired because their employer found pornography on their work computer. And that's another way to do something that's very risky. But they want to do more and more risky behavior because it increases the adrenaline and it fires up the dopamine and makes a much better high for them.
It's a better high. They're going for that high. Often I've thought, you know, again, that thinking process is off. Their thinking process is off. Most of us know that when we're in professional positions, or this is not even professional, because I've seen it with many who are not in professional positions, but they're just at their regular 9-to-5. And they, as you said, that leakage spills over into the work. And you know your brain has got to be off if you are doing porn on your work computer. So many times we find that these people have, with their non-thinking, gone so far out on a limb that those of us who are in our right mind, so to speak, you know, their employers are thinking, why would you have all of these websites on your computer? Why would you even try to break through the firewall that we have set up to protect you? Why would you find a way to go around that so you can look at these sites while you're at work? So that you can go to the bathroom in the middle of the day. And this is for men, or I've seen it both in men and women. During the day, they can't get through their day without being sexual with themselves. You know, they get that buzz from the computer, and like you said, the risky behaviors begin to mount up. And before you know it, you know, they're 15, 20 minutes, 30, taking a 30-minute break in the bathroom just so they can calm themselves down.
Exactly. And that happens a lot with our addicts. By the time they get to us, because they've had such a hidden life, their behavior's way out there for a lot of these guys. I had one of my clients a couple of years ago tell me that the amount of money that he spent on sex workers and women and trying to keep up this lifestyle was $850,000.
Wow.
I'm always amazed at the amount of money that folks can get away with spending. This guy happened to be single, but I've had a lot of men who were married show up with, you know, not nearly that much, but in the hundreds of thousands.
And I see that part of your
spending it on their sex addiction.
I see that part of your program there at your treatment center is about financial addictions as well. Because I can see where that goes into play in terms of the sexual addiction that they've put themselves out there. It's like playing Russian roulette a gambling addiction with your life and with sex. The only difference is that your drug of choice is sex.
Right. And some of them will fuse their addictions. For example, there are a lot of men who have these two fused, sex and cocaine.
Okay, let's hold it right there for a minute, that they have a sex and cocaine fusing their addictions. We'll be right back. Emotions are us.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
So, Ava, you were saying these addictions get fused together. You were talking about sex and cocaine.
Yes, sex and cocaine, especially crack cocaine, often get fused together. And the other chemical that gets fused with it is crystal meth. We have a lot of people that come in with those addictions fused. They can't be sexual without the crystal meth. They can't use crystal meth without being sexual. Or with the cocaine, they can't be sexual without using cocaine, and they can't use cocaine without immediately being sexual. When those addictions get fused together, they have to be treated for both addictions simultaneously. Otherwise, they will just keep relapsing.
And that makes a whole lot of sense. And it's interesting, you know, you said earlier that your clientele is a cash basis. So we know that they're paying for this out of pocket. And so most of society would not think that this upper echelon of clientele would be using crack cocaine. And I have said this for years and years in my practice. I don't care what your economical status is, crack cocaine is a walking warrior on your life.
Yeah. It's like having a ball and chain behind you.
Yes.
You're dragging.
And people think that crack cocaine, that's such a low life condition drug. Nobody uses, you know, people at that upper echelon doesn't use, crack cocaine. They're going to do powder or something like that. But crack It's cheap. It's
I've had two physicians that have come in with those two addictions fused.
Mm-hmm. Listen to this, audience. Two doctors.
With those addictions fused, cocaine and sex addiction.
Cocaine and sex. And crystal meth is another one out there that's very popular. You're right. The sex gets fused with it, and the behaviors that they do when they're on these two drugs, it seems to me as if it lets all inhibitions down.
Right. And then when you put crystal meth in the body, it drives your sex drive way up.
Your libido goes way up.
Way up.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to move to another area. I wanted to talk about, usually when people think about sex addicts, they think about the ones who they read in the newspaper, the ones that make the headline news. But more than likely, I don't know what the numbers are, and perhaps you do, you could share that with us. But there's a high number of persons who are acting out in this way, and they have a proclivity for younger children, younger adults. They might have certain sort of nuances that they want in sex that's not what we would call, quote unquote, normal. If there's any such thing in sex, it's like normal. But it leads into pedophilia. I wanted to ask you about that. Where does pedophile and pedophilia add up on this timeline here?
So very good question. And I want to actually touch on three pieces: sex addiction, pedophiles, and sex offenders, because they're three basically different things. So sex addiction, we've talked about before. We use very similar criteria that we do for alcoholism or substance use disorder to define sex addiction. Now, pedophiles are people who want to be sexual with underage people, so with children. And then I want to define sex offender. Sex offender, if you think about it in terms of violating boundaries, that's the best way to think about sex offenders. So a lot of sex addicts are sex offenders. I would say maybe 15%. The sex addicts who are pedophiles are less than 10%, way less than 10%, probably 5 or 6%. But then when you look at the pedophilia population, 70% of pedophiles are also sex addicts. I don't know what the statistics are for sex offenders, but I want to talk about the ways that a sex addict moves into sex offending. So when you think of it in terms of legality, state by state, it can be a little bit different, but they call a sex offender a person who has offended someone in a sexual way. So, for example, rape, that's the easiest one to see. But someone who exposes themselves in public with no clothes on, that would be a sexual offender. And a sex addict may have that as one of their arousal templates or their only arousal template. And then being sexual in places that you're not supposed to be sexual. For example, I had one man that came in who had been having sex in an airplane in the close to the cockpit in the restroom. And then we also have those folks that we used to call peeping toms that are voyeurs. So they want to look into other people's houses, into their windows, and visualize someone else who doesn't know that they're being seen. So those are the primary ways. But I also want to talk about pornography, and in particular, child pornography. So when someone is using pornography, just general pornography online, what we find today in the pornography isn't your basic plain vanilla two people making love and enjoying their sexuality. There's a lot of deviant behavior on on the pornography of today, and it seems to be getting worse. So people will be drawn into looking at child pornography that would not normally ever even consider that once they start crossing that line of violating boundaries. So they may be looking at other pornography and run across child pornography because the folks who make pornography will try to send you little pings and ways to try to hook you in into something other than what you're looking at. And so when it crosses that line into looking at child pornography, there's so many people that have started looking at child pornography in numbers that are unbelievable, but they would never have considered looking at child pornography if they hadn't crossed the line from just, you know, experimenting with pornography to looking at it more and more and more, to the point that the pornography they're looking at, this probably not very nice pornography, is not enough. And so they escalate to looking at child pornography. And that what we know is that the instant someone clicks on a child pornography website, they go on the FBI watch list. And then they will watch them for a while. And when they see that behavior escalate, then they will start to monitor them and perhaps even may get arrested. But there's people who often think that a sex addict is always a pedophile. And that is not true. Less than 10, maybe less than 5% of sex addicts are pedophiles. They may strictly be looking at pornography, or they may just be having affairs, which I say that, I don't say that lightly. That's a big word, having an affair, but they just start to go offline. And so there's a big difference between a sex offender, a sex addict, and a pedophile. So lots of sex offenders are not pedophiles. And then there are pedophiles who may cross that line into, may get arrested, and then they're labeled as sex offenders. And so it depends on the laws in the state. And for example, statutory rape, what we used to call statutory rape, or what we call today sex with a minor, because we know that minors are not emotionally prepared and sexually prepared to give consent for sex.
That is so interesting that we know that minors under the age of 18 are not prepared for that life of sex and what all it entails. But yet at the same time, we have laws in place that they can, in some states, walk in and buy a rifle.
Right.
You know, that may be neither here nor there, but it goes along with that risky behavior starting at a real young age. Do you find that as you've been studying this over the years, that our population is getting younger and younger with its addictions?
So, very good question. Yes. And about, let's see, it was 2010 when I trained in my sexual addiction therapy training. And back then, the earliest age of exposure to pornography was somewhere between 9 and 10. The age is now down to 7. There's a lot of good research on how, what age do children get exposed to pornography. And so children are running across it accidentally. So important for parents to have filters on their computers. But the age at which they're exposed is getting younger because you can access it from game consoles. People, kids walk around with phones all the time. You can access it easily from phones without filters. And so, we have a hypersexualized society because of all of the media. There's much less censorship. You know, I was watching a black and white TV show the other day, and mom and dad were in separate beds. They were single beds. When I was a kid, you would not see a television show where mom and dad were in the same bed. That's how censored it was back then. And today, people are, you know, almost having sex on TV at, you know, 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon, or sometimes even in the daytime. So our television and other media have now present children who are really not ready to see it with sexual events.
I hear that, and I believe that, having been in practice for as many years as I have and treated several children who at that age of between 5 and 7, 8 years old are already sexualized, having sex, have a sexual addiction, perpetrate and penetrate their brothers and sisters because their mind is not developed and their thinking process is really off. These children are sneaky. They feel entitled. It's almost as if they have a dual personality, you know, one mm-hmm. of being the perfect little boy or girl with all the mannerisms. And then at night, before we put cameras up in their room, we find that they're these 7, 8 years old. They're up all night with their iPad or their phone or the mother's phone or somebody's phone that they found. They're up and they're watching porn all night, which is why they don't want to go to school in the morning.
So the youngest child that we have gotten a call for to work with was 5 years old, little girl who was compulsively masturbating. And then the youngest child that we've actually had into our office to be treated was 6 years old. And I heard a couple of months ago that the first six-year-old was actually admitted into a treatment center for sex addiction and compulsive sexual behavior. We are reluctant to say that a child or an adolescent is a sex addict. What we do is call that compulsive sexual behavior. They're not choosing to do this, really, because they've experienced what we call super stimulus. When a child is prepubescent and they experience sexual stimulation by either a peer, an older sibling, or an adult, that experience still feels good to them, even though they have no idea what's going on. They don't know that that's sex. It still feels really good because our genitals work the moment that we're born. They do feel a good sensation when they are stimulated. And so these kids have the super stimulus, something they've never experienced before. Someone's touching them and it feels really good. Most children feel good and happy about it and shame and guilt at the same time. And when an experience like that happens where there's a super stimulus, the child is both repulsed and extremely attracted to that situation, to that event, to that experience, that feeling that they have. And it's like trying to keep them from going outside to play. They want to go outside and play. They can't prevent themselves because they don't have the ability to contain themselves or set limits on themselves. And so, you know, if it feels that good, they're going to do it a lot.
I also want to put out there about rape, since we're talking about children and trauma.
Yes.
One of the things that happens in the brain when rape is going on, the biological part of your body, no matter what age you are, it has a mind of its own. It's going to do its own thing. And even though the child, be it a boy or a girl, is in that situation where I call it trauma, just all of it, rape. I don't make any difference about that in terms of the status. It's rape to me when you're violated against your wishes. But my point is that the biological part of our body, these young minds experience orgasm.
Right.
These young minds experience an orgasm, and it's not that they want to or it just happens biologically, but that gets imprinted on that template, as you call it. That gets imprinted on that template,
right,
and is fueled around and shadowed with guilt and shame, which in their later years leads them to that promiscuity and sex, drugs, and rock and roll, as we've been talking about today.
We also do something called PTSI-R. The PTSI-R is a post-traumatic stress inventory, and we do that to figure out what their earliest traumas were related to sexuality. Because when trauma and sexuality happen at the same time, that becomes a part of what we call their arousal template. So the things that were traumatic for them that related to sexuality as a child often become fused with their arousal template. I'll give you an example. So someone that I know from recovery said that when he was a little boy, so he's a heterosexual man, but his part of his arousal template is putting on female clothes. And he doesn't want to be a female, but what it does is it creates arousal for him. So as a little boy, what happened to him is when his mother was leaving for work and he was feeling sad and starting to feel abandonment by her, she would lay her clothing down on the bed, and then after she left, had already gone to work, he would pick up her clothing and hold it close as a way to comfort himself. And eventually, when he started to learn how to masturbate, he would hold the clothing as a way to comfort himself and masturbate. Then later on, he started putting the clothing on. So that trauma of the abandonment of mom going to work got fused with sexuality for him. So he could not get aroused unless he was putting on female clothing. Had nothing to do with his sexual preference.
Ava, this is a topic that we can talk forever about. We're going to bring this to a close, and listening audience, know that you can find more information on our show webpage at America Out Loud. Ava, thank you so much for being on the show today. I so appreciate you.
You are so welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
You are so welcome as well. I look forward to another talk with Ava Pravada. Thank you so much.
Thank you.